Welcome to The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker in Woods Hole. It's Friday, July 23rd. This is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes, Sam Houghton, and Daniel Ackerman. We'll speak with George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll hear from Casey Myers at the Provincetown Independent and Jason Graciade at N Magazine. And we'll speak with Noah Asimow at the Vineyard Gazette and CAI's Eve Zukoff. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. It's been a number of weeks since the pandemic was the top story here at the Roundup, but this week there's no avoiding it as case numbers have been climbing once more, particularly in Provincetown. CAI's Jeanette Barnes was in Provincetown reporting yesterday and joins us now. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, great to be here, Steve.
And we have with us CAI's Morning Edition producer and reporter, Sam Houghton. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Steve.
Sam, start us off with the latest numbers. Give us a sense of the size of this recent spike that we've seen, and what do we know about who's getting infected?
Yeah, so on Monday, the town reported that about 130 people had tested positive that had been in Provincetown. Then on Wednesday, that jumped to over 250, so almost doubling in 2 days. They think that's from the 4th of July weekend, and we know from the past that these holidays can trigger spikes in cases. Because people are gathering. It's important to say that, they've been testing a lot and that could be inflating the numbers, but still the town is by far the highest test positivity rate in the state. The percentage of people testing positive in Provincetown is north of 12%, while the state average is less than 1%. Also, many people have tested positive, have already been vaccinated. So we're seeing these breakthrough cases. And then 190 of the people who tested positive are Massachusetts residents, and a little more than half of those are from the Cape, so people from out of state as well. And contact tracers connected these cases to 32 different establishments throughout Provincetown, so it seemed like it was around the whole town.
Jeanette, this is pretty much the high summer moment. You talked with store owners and tourists and folks at the vaccination and testing site. What's the mood like in town right now? How aware do people seem to be of a spike in cases happening?
Well, yeah, I've been reporting from Provincetown the past two Thursdays. And so last week, I talked to a visitor from Canada who hadn't even heard there was an uptick in the area. But by this week, everyone seems to be aware of it. I talked to some tourists from a couple of different families staying in other towns on the Cape who were in Provincetown for the day. They said that they were somewhat concerned, but not enough to change their plans to come. They were still happy to be there. Walking up and down Commercial Street, a few people were wearing masks, but the vast majority, I would say, were not. In terms of the mood, one store owner said it's a real mix of some people being worried and then others who are just ready to party, especially if they missed out last year. So that's definitely mixed. Michael Myers, who runs the clothing store Wardrobe, owns the store. He said everything was crowded around the 4th of July, but now he feels like he's actually seeing fewer people than normal these last couple of weeks. And he's worried about business falling off or even the season shutting down early if cases continue to grow.
You can imagine as word spreads that that's happening, that there'd be fear or concern among business owners in Provincetown that people might be avoiding Provincetown going forward this summer. Sam, the health board in Provincetown issued an advisory this week. What are they recommending now?
Yeah, this is a mask advisory. Basically, if you're inside in public, the town is recommending you do wear a mask, even outside if you can't socially distance. And that's for vaccinated people, too. Also, they are recommending that bars and nightclubs, basically anywhere that has tight quarters, they recommend that they check vaccination cards before letting people in. We know that a number of places are doing that. So this advisory was issued on Monday after an emergency meeting was called between the select board and the health board. But not everyone was in agreement that this was the best course of action. Some wanted the town to take a stronger stance. One select board member, Bobby Anthony, He was the most outspoken. He said the town should enact a mask requirement that would require people to wear their mask indoors. So he's basically arguing that an advisory is essentially what everyone is already doing, and it's not enough. But the majority of both boards thought the advisory wasn't too drastic and would suffice. They did decide that things, you know, continue to get worse if COVID cases climb, and important thing here, if hospitalizations climb, they would circle back and adopt tougher regulations. So I think this is one of those learning points in the pandemic. You know, it's kind of a new stage, so to speak. In the next couple of weeks, we'll be tallying on what's our proper response. And local, county, and you know, really state officials are paying attention to what's happening here in Provincetown.
And Jeanette, how much is there a sense that this is specific to Provincetown? It's such a densely populated town in the summer, and people come out to party. They do know how to do it in Provincetown. How much could that be a factor here?
Yeah, well, as you mentioned, it really is the height of the summer season on the Cape and Islands all over. Provincetown also has some of its annual theme weeks that draw a lot of people. So that's happening in the background. Some business owners did mention that, and the crowding that happens in different venues and at private parties. But a man I met who was getting tested for COVID-19 over at the community center, he had a little bit of a counter to that. He said, look, if you're a resort town with people coming from all over the country, this kind of cluster could happen in your town next. This is really not just a Provincetown thing. And that's true in the sense that while there is a larger outbreak in Provincetown than most of Massachusetts, officials for Barnstable County have said there are increases in cases all over the Cape. So that's something to look out for. One complication for Provincetown coming up is that next week's theme is actually Family Week. That's full of events for LGBTQ+ parents and their kids, including kids under 12 who are not eligible for the vaccine. So it's likely a lot of families will be wearing masks. And of course, as Sam talked about, there is that advisory for mask wearing. So we'll have to see how that plays out.
Sam, what about these breakthrough infections? How worried do officials seem about that aspect of the situation?
Yeah. So as of at least this week, the people, you know, who have tested positive, who have been vaccinated, aren't getting as sick. They aren't requiring hospitalization, at least. And that's what town, you know, county officials, that's what they're really paying attention to here. But it's definitely, you know, it's a concern. This came up at Martha's Vineyard. Hospital CEO Denisha Pisi, we spoke to her. She said they haven't had one person admitted to the hospital because of COVID. And she says that's remarkable considering the number of cases they've had recently. The Vineyard, at least for people who are eligible, is over 90% fully vaccinated. So really all the health officials we heard from are still very confident in the vaccine and are pushing, you know, people to get jabbed if they haven't already. But these breakthrough cases are a concern. You know, one Provincetown Health Board member said it's requiring kind of a change of attitude. He said that, you know, getting vaccinated felt like the pandemic was over for him at first, but he doesn't feel that anymore with what's going on in Provincetown. Now, important to say here, they do think these cases of vaccinated people are related to the Delta variant, which, of course, is the more contagious and spreads much faster than prior strains.
Let's talk about the Delta variant a moment. Sam, you reported that this has now been confirmed really for the first time in our region on Martha's Vineyard. There was a lot of talk that this was around, but nobody knew for certain. Now we know for certain. What do we know about these cases on the Vineyard?
Yeah, there was speculation, right, as you were saying, that the variant was on the island last week when they did see a jump in cases. I guess it wasn't a huge jump. There were 16 cases reported, but that's more than the prior 6 weeks. But then you're right. On Wednesday, the hospital confirmed that there were two cases of the Delta variant on the island. That's since jumped to four as of yesterday, and all four are among people fully vaccinated. But again, the hospital says these four were showing just mild cases, and right, they haven't had any hospitalizations. So this is the first confirmed case for the Cape and the Islands. But right, it's safe to assume that this jump in Provincetown was likely fueled by the Delta variant. They just haven't got the lab results back as far as we've heard. This came up on Nantucket too. The town also issued a mask advisory, basically with the assumption that the Delta variant is out there, and vaccinated or not, you know, masking is still a personal choice, but they're saying it's the safe option.
I think public health officials right now going under the assumption that the Delta variant is pretty much everywhere. CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Sam Houghton, thanks to you both.
Thanks, Steve.
Vaccines are going mobile in New Bedford. Our South Coast reporter Daniel Ackerman covered this story this week. He joins us now. Hi, Daniel.
Hey, Steve.
So tell us, what is the new vaccine strategy for New Bedford?
Well, they're sending out a fleet of vans into various New Bedford neighborhoods. So they're going to target the parts of the city that have the lowest vaccination rates. And the vans are going to offer a choice of either the one-shot Johnson & Johnson vaccine or a dose of the two-shot Pfizer sequence. And these mobile clinics, which will be stationed around the city, are also going to be a base for canvassers. So teams of people are going to go door-to-door in those neighborhoods just to provide people with more info about the vaccines. And they're going to offer in-home shots for people who either can't or maybe don't want to come out to those mobile clinics. So today there's going to be a couple of mobile clinics from 1 to 8 p.m. One will be at Ashley Park and the other at the Blue Meadows Housing Authority. And those locations are going to change each day for the rest of the month. So people can check the schedule online. That'll be at cic-health.com/New Bedford.
So what's behind this? Why did the city make this move now?
Yeah, so as of yesterday, about 42% of New Bedford residents are fully vaccinated. And that's well below the statewide average, and that's below where public health experts say it needs to be. So I spoke with Damone Chaplin. He heads the city's health department. And he told me that this localized approach with the mobile clinics, excuse me, is a way to provide more culturally specific information about the vaccines. So those door-to-door canvassers, for example, they're going to be multilingual teams, so they can talk to people in Spanish, Quiche, Portuguese, Cape Verdean Creole, just to try to best address any concerns or hesitancy that people might be feeling about the shot. And Chaplin also told me that the city's really pushing to get as many people vaccinated this summer before schools reopen in the fall.
I want to talk about another story you reported this week. It's on the scrap metal operation at Brayton Point in Somerset. You've been doing ongoing reporting on this. Tell us what's happening now.
Yeah, so maybe just to start with a bit of background, Brayton Point is this peninsula on Mount Hope Bay, and it used to be the site of a coal-fired power plant for decades. But a few years ago in 2017, that plant shut down, and then it was demolished in 2019. And the company that came in to redevelop the site is called Commercial Development Company. They promised to turn the area into like a staging site to assemble offshore wind turbines. Now that hasn't quite happened yet. They haven't gotten contracts from the wind industry to do that yet. And instead, the company is renting out space on the pier to a scrap metal operation. So that's what residents are not happy about. They say that metal dust is blowing into the neighborhood. A study commissioned by the town actually found that dust contained lead and mercury. But then the operation is also quite noisy. If you go down there by the water, you can just hear the clanging of scrap metal throughout the day as trucks come in and dump more scrap onto the pile. So residents that I talked to actually call that sound metal thunder, as if it's become just part of the weather at Brayton Point. But the news this week is that the select board in Somerset delivered a letter to Governor Charlie Baker's office. And they're actually asking the governor to shut down the scrap metal operation because they say it's happening on state-owned land. Now, I went back and looked through the property records at the Fall River Registry of Deeds. And yeah, it does look like the commercial development company is leasing that land from the state. So Somerset residents are basically saying, hey, Governor Baker, your tenant on state-owned land is causing all kinds of problems, potentially violating the Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act. So they're asking the governor to step in and shut down the scrap metal operation.
There are a lot of moving parts in this story. Going forward now, what are we watching? What are we looking for?
Well, I'm definitely will be waiting to see if Governor Baker responds to this letter. In the past, he has said publicly he's not convinced the state actually owns that land. though he hasn't said why he's unsure about that. So I'll definitely keep an eye out for his response. And then elsewhere on the state level, the matter could be going to court. So back in May, State Attorney General Maura Healey issued a 60-day notice of intent to sue the scrap metal operation for potentially violating environmental laws. That 60-day period has ended, so we'll be watching to see if the AG follows through with a lawsuit. So in the coming weeks and months, I expect a lot more to move forward with this story.
That is CAI South Coast reporter Daniel Ackerman. Daniel, thanks.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. Martha's Vineyard is tethered to the mainland by a small number of power cables. One of them failed last Friday, causing brownouts on the island. George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times joins us with this story and more. Hi, George.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
George, what do we know about what happened with this electric power cable, and tell us how it affected the island?
Well, we don't know the specifics of what happened yet, but what we do know is that last Friday there were some mysterious power outages scattered across the island, many of them centered in Edgartown. And, you know, it affected our office here, so we started making some phone calls and trying to figure out what was going on. Because the weather was perfectly fine, it wasn't windy, we didn't have a storm, there was nothing like that. So why was this happening? And we really couldn't get an answer at that point, but Eversource eventually told officials on the island that one of their undersea cables, one of four of them that come from the mainland to the island, failed. And they had started to send over some generators as a backup. They were able to restore the power fairly quickly, within 5 minutes. However, this has been something that's been on the minds of folks on the island for quite a while, that this is sort of a precarious way to be getting the electricity from the mainland to the island, you know, and whether there should be a source of power here. Eversource, in fact, at one point had plans to put a battery facility here, and we're told by one of the fire chiefs that they've abandoned that plan as being a little bit too costly to do. So for now, we have these cables that are coming to the island. One of them's in disrepair. The other ones, people are worried, you know, that those have outlived their useful life. So what's next? We're all going to have to stay tuned, and I would think leaders here on the island are working toward a solution with Eversource on what to do.
Mm. I want to ask you about another story you've got this week. Islanders will be able to purchase marijuana soon, legally, I should say.
Yeah, so this is 10 years in the making almost. Jeff Rose is the person who initially started the ball rolling once cannabis was legalized in Massachusetts to bring medical marijuana to the island, and that's what's happening today. It's not his shop that's opening up today. He did sell the rights to that to another company called Fine Fettle, and they're opening a soft opening today in West Tisbury with their medical marijuana facility. But Jeff Rose has kept some skin in the game here, and he is working to open an adult use marijuana shop in Vineyard Haven. He expects that either the first or second week in August. So again, for right now, only medical marijuana users can get marijuana at the facility in West Tisbury, and then the Tisbury or Vineyard Haven facility will open sometime in the first couple of weeks in August.
So going forward, pretty soon, there'll be two places open.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And there's things in the pipeline for even more. The West Tisbury facility is licensed as well for adult use marijuana. They're not ready to begin selling that yet. And right on the same street where Jeff Rose is opening his facility, there's another company that has an agreement with the town of Tisbury to open a facility on Mechanic Street as well, and they're going through the process of getting that licensed. So there's apparently business to be had here on the island. Jeff Rose points out that, you know, the island population grows by 100,000 every week in the summertime, so there are a lot of people out there who may be excited about the possibility of being able to get marijuana legally here on the island.
As George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Steve. Have a good weekend.
Chatham and Harwich have a combined school district. Now the towns are looking at changing the funding formula for their elementary schools. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle can educate us on what's happening here. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Tim, we've talked in the past about declining enrollments at schools. This plays a part in this story, right?
Sure, it definitely does. What that has done is created a disparity between what it costs to educate students in Chatham, at Chatham Elementary School, where the drop in enrollment has been pretty precipitous over the past few years, and Harwich Elementary School, which has maintained a pretty even enrollment. What they're proposing, what the district is proposing, is changing the regional agreement, which currently requires that each town contribute to the operating costs of the entire district based on a rolling enrollment figure, which means right now that Harwich pays 75% of the cost and Chatham pays 25% of the cost. What this proposal would do would mean that each town would cover the entire operating costs of its own elementary school. Currently, Harwich is really subsidizing Chatham because of that enrollment split. But under this agreement, change in wording, basically it would shift about $600,000 from the Harwich side of the ledger to the Chatham side. A working group of school and town officials came up with this proposal, and Monomoy Superintendent Scott Carpenter submitted a draft change to the school committee just a week ago. And that would in practical terms, decrease Harwich's cost by $600,000 and increase Chatham's. You know, we've talked about before the importance people, especially in Chatham, have put on retaining their elementary school despite those falling enrollments. And one of the other alternatives to this situation has been to create a upper and lower elementary school, one in Harwich and one in Chatham. But Chatham residents and town officials have opposed this because they don't see that as really keeping a locally identifiable elementary school in town. And during discussions about this over the spring, folks in Chatham, including the select board, have said that they're willing to pay more to keep Chatham Elementary School open.
Tell us how much more this could cost Chatham then.
Well, it'll cost about $600,000 a year more at this point. And the whole proposal has to go through quite a process to be approved. It must school committee is the first one that needs to give its approval to this language change, followed by the boards of selectmen and select board, and then town meeting, and of course the Department of Education also has to approve that. Now Carpenter says that this language that he used was drawn from the Mount Greylock Regional School District, which has a similar situation with two towns and two elementary schools, and he says he's confident that that language, which has already been approved by the state, would pass muster with the Department of Ed. There are a number of other changes to the regional agreement that are being proposed, and all of those, as well as this sort of key one, will go before the school committee on August 11th. And if they approve it, it'll then go on to the select board in Chatham and the board of selectmen in Harwich.
Mm. A number of moving parts there. It's Tim Wood.
Quite a bit.
Yeah, of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Steve.
The Outer Cape is experiencing an historic mosquito swarm. If the sound of that makes you shudder, you're not alone. Casey Myers of the Provincetown Independent is here to tell us what's caused this and why that cause has gotten plenty of people buzzing. Hi, Casey.
Hello, Steve. I like it. I like that intro.
We're working to bring you on properly here. Tell us about this mosquito swarm and why it's been so much bigger than usual.
Yes. So it is historically bad. Like you said, Gabriel Sikowski, the superintendent of Cape Cod Mosquito Control, says her organization keeps traps around the Cape to document the number of mosquitoes in an area in any given 24-hour period. And the traps where this problem has originated have been routinely amassing 2,000 mosquitoes per day since May. And Gabriel says if it's anywhere over 200 mosquitoes, that's unusual. So this is indeed, as she says, it's historic. And the reason for the swarm can be found in Wellfleet, North Wellfleet, on the Bayside at a beach called Duck Harbor, which is part of the Herring River Basin. And it's basically an area that has had a dune buildup for years that is separating the ocean from a marshy area. But over the past winter, the dune has been eroded, has been flattened. And so now salt water gets into this large marshy area, and it doesn't really drain out. Hmm. So it creates the perfect environment for mosquitoes to breed like crazy. And it's brackish water, too, so it attracts a particular kind of mosquito. So anyway, the Cape Cod Mosquito Control recognized this problem in May and said, you know, and went right to the Cape Cod National Seashore, which is the boundaries where Duck Harbor is in the Herring River Basin. And they said, you know, this is going to be a huge problem soon. But because it's the National Seashore, they had to go through a process. You can't just kill anything in the seashore. You have to go through, you have to kind of have a justification, a higher purpose besides just people don't like mosquitoes. And in this case, they did get permission to spray with larvicide, but it didn't come until July. And by that time, the larva had matured into about a bazillion mosquitoes. Mm-hmm. And so that's the problem. Now they are doing larvicide treatments. And I personally think I've noticed a difference because I do happen to live in this area. It's not a small area. Mosquitoes can travel about 10 miles. So even though this is a particular area of North Wellfleet, people in Truro are feeling it. People in East Ham might even be feeling it. It's quite extensive.
You told us that a typical trap, when it's bad, might catch 200 mosquitoes. They're catching 2,000. If you live in that area, what has it been like?
Well, it's just like you have chocolate chips all over your body. You suddenly you're walking outside of your car and you're looking at your body and it is just covered in mosquitoes. You kind of like see them before they start biting you. And I went to a field called Baker Field, and it was just a little bit marshy feeling. I guess there's just been a lot of rain, and I mean, the mosquitoes just covered me. So it's really bad. I mean, people just don't go outside. They don't go into their garden. It's they've been spraying quite a bit. The Cape Cod Mosquito Control has been spraying and getting a lot of calls for treating lawns, and they can't quite keep up with it, I guess, but it's a problem.
If this happens again here at Duck Harbor, is there going to be a process in place so that there's not this lag in permitting or whatever that was that sort of they knew this was coming, but they couldn't make it happen quick enough to treat it? Will this happen again in the future, or are they going to address the process?
Yeah, exactly. Well, they are working on a process, according to the Cape Cod National Seashore officials. And it's actually a national problem where local mosquito controls kind of butt heads with the Park Service in issues like this. And they are kind of hoping to work out a faster process. So I don't know. I guess that's under discussions. But it is going to be a problem because these dunes aren't going to be rebuilt, that's for sure. So we know now that this is a new marshy area. And the long-term picture, now that you mention it, is going to be that the Herring River Restoration Project is going to start to change that entire area. So there'll be much more tidal flow and a lot more water. And the hope is, well, not the hope, the scientists really say this is what's going to happen, that the kind of species that eat the mosquito larvae will be able to come in and eventually live in this area as well as the mosquitoes and kill the mosquitoes. So there could be a natural solution too. But that's, I mean, the Herring River Restoration Project is about at least a year away from even starting. Mm. And it's going to be about a 20-year process total. So no short-term solution there.
So keep swatting those mosquitoes.
Exactly.
Casey Myers of the Provincetown Independent. Casey, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker, broadcasting from Woods Hole. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll be speaking with Jason Graziadei of N Magazine and editor of N Nantucket Current. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on the Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. An uptick in COVID cases is happening on Nantucket, as in many other places. Jason Graziadei of N Magazine and editor of Nantucket Current has details on this and joins us now. Hi, Jason.
Good morning. Good morning, Steve. How are you?
Jason, tell us about what's happening right now with the COVID numbers and what the response is like on the island.
Sure. So over the past week, health officials have disclosed that the island's confirmed 14 new COVID-19 cases. So over the past 2 days, there's been a number of developments around that. On Wednesday, the town issued a mask advisory, urging residents and visitors to wear masks indoors and in public when they can't distance. Again, this is an advisory, so not a requirement. Yesterday, the hospital announced, citing a regional surge in COVID-19 cases, that they would be expanding the testing operation there at the hospital in the Anderson building. And also yesterday, a number of cases at the Nantucket Yacht Club among staff and members there prompted the club to close down until further notice as they test about 80 staff members, hopefully today. The latest wastewater sampling, which is done weekly by the town, shows, reflects these numbers, that there is an uptick in the prevalence of virus in the island's wastewater. So we'll all be watching, over the next week how this plays out.
Even the yacht club had to close as a number of people there tested positive?
Yeah, so the Nantucket Yacht Club sent out a notice to their members yesterday that they would be closing until further notice after three club members and staff members tested positive. So out of an abundance of caution, the general manager there has closed down the club, arranging for about 80 staff members to be tested today and seeing what those results come out before letting people back into the club.
And it sounds like, as elsewhere around the region right now, the suspicion is that this is the Delta variant, but there's no definitive proof right now, right?
That's correct. So the Nantucket Health Department Director, Roberto Santamaria, said, they believe that the Delta variant is here. That's how we're getting these breakthrough cases of among people who are fully vaccinated. They haven't done the gene sequencing yet to actually confirm that, but they do believe that the variant is here on the island and causing these breakthroughs.
As the island is sort of trying to go forward with this, what's happening with some of the other things that have been put into place around this, like outdoor dining, right? That's going to be extended?
Correct. So, obviously this is something that's around the Commonwealth. Towns permitting outdoor dining in public sidewalks and streets. Nantucket was no different. It was hugely popular. But, of course, there's some issues that arose with this, which the select board discussed this week. They did vote to extend outdoor dining through the end of this year. August 15th had been the sort of cutoff date where they had to renew the special permitting. So they did vote to renew it, but they are looking at some issues for the next year and whether they should bring it back at all. Should they charge restaurants for using public sidewalks and public streets? A lot of these issues that go into equity with restaurants that may not be able to extend their premises. So they're going to be looking at all these issues moving forward to see if, hopefully post-COVID times, should outdoor dining remain the same or what changes need to be made.
Hey, Jason, let me ask you about another story you're covering. This has to do with Nantucket's second marijuana dispensary. It's opening soon.
Yes, Act Natural is the island's second cannabis dispensary, and it is opening tomorrow. They just got their final approval from the Massachusetts Cannabis Commission. So Act Natural, Mike Sullivan and Doug Layton, partners in this new venture, and, you know, checked in with them over the past month to really see, you know, do they feel, obviously they feel that the demand will be there for a small island to have two cannabis dispensaries. So they feel like they've crunched the numbers, their business plan is solid, and they'll be opening for business and welcoming in customers to their dispensary out by the airport on Nantucket tomorrow.
That is Jason Graziadei of N Magazine, editor of Nantucket Current. Jason, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We heard earlier how a power cable to the vineyard failed last week, causing brownouts to the island. It has highlighted a now abandoned plan by utility company Eversource to build a battery backup on the island. Noah Asimo of the Vineyard Gazette is here to talk about that plan and what happened to it. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Steve.
This is a story really about the island's energy future, right? Battery storage was supposed to be a part of it. Tell us about the battery project. What was it supposed to do?
So the battery project, I mean, at least the initial vision or primary purpose of the project was to significantly reduce the island's reliance on five approximately, you know, they total about 13 megawatt diesel-fired generators that are used to supply backup power to the island during high load conditions in the peak summer months. The island's actually serviced by an aging energy infrastructure that includes the undersea cables that run from Falmouth to West Chop and East Chop. There's four of those, and as you said, one of them was compromised earlier this week. So during the summer, when energy needs increase, the Eversource needs to kick in the backup generators, but they're fired by diesel power, one. And two, essentially, the battery storage facility would have helped sort of phase them out, and it would have deferred the need for a new undersea cable and helped reduce strain on the grid because it would have been able to store power in a way that the diesel generators don't. So there could have been additional capacity. It could have shaved yearly and monthly peaks for the island. But the plan has been canceled by Eversource, at least as of this May.
So what are some of the reasons Eversource says that they're not going to go forward with it?
Well, it's really sort of twofold. The plan, the battery storage facility was going to be built in the Oak Bluffs service station that the company has, but they did a feasibility analysis earlier this year, and according to Eversource, it showed an increased future load forecast for Martha's Vineyard, as well as increased project costs. The increased future load forecast is kind of interesting. Essentially, what happened was Eversource, according to Eversource, severely underestimated the amount of electric energy that the island's going to need moving into the future. And essentially what happened was they said, oh, this battery storage facility that we're going to build is not going to be enough. We're going to need to build a fifth cable, but building a fifth cable and building the battery storage facility is going to be really expensive, and we think that the fifth cable will be enough to be able to supply the island with its energy needs. But that decision came out of, according to Eversource, conversations with the island's Green Energy Climate Task Force, which has in five of the six island towns passed these fossil fuel reduction goals, which would hopefully reduce fossil fuels by 50% in 2030 and 100% by 2040. So there are all these moving parts to it, and it's, I think, sort of a fascinating example of what's challenging the island's energy infrastructure right now.
I'm curious when the energy company says, oh, we underestimated the energy use of the island
right.
in the future, what does that mean? Does that mean that they think that there's growth on the island, or as the island switches to a more electric-dependent future, that also just is going to increase the load that much more?
Yeah, it really is both those things, I think. What was kind of interesting speaking with some of the people on the Climate Action Task Force about their conversations with Eversource was that even at the beginning, back in 2018 when the project was filed, Eversource was underestimating the amount of energy that the island was going to need, according to them. It just didn't even match energy usage changes from the prior, you know, 5 or 10 years. And then I think once they started talking to the Climate Action Task Force and realizing that really the island's goal was to essentially go all electric during that time period, they were like, no, we don't really have the ability to do this right now. But according to people at the Climate Action Task Force, you know, they think they do, and it really is a feasible goal. It's just they need to get Eversource on board. But Eversource is, you know, they're the largest public utility in New England. And essentially the way they plan is that they react to need, according to people who are familiar with sort of the conversations with them, and rather than sort of engaging in more long-term planning discussions that are like, hey, we really want to do this, when we're going to need, you know, battery storage, and we're going to need a cable for it to be possible.
In the meantime, the island will, what, continue to be burning diesel? You have a number here of 300,000 to 500,000 gallons of diesel per year for the next 5 years?
Yeah, those are that's the estimate that the people who work on the Climate Action Task Force are giving for sort of what it takes to fire the backup generators, which everyone knows the island's population is growing. There are a lot of people here even right now. And those are necessary, especially with we saw the aging cable infrastructure this past weekend. So, yes, that's sort of the immediate future. Eversource has said that they are in conversations about building the fifth cable, that the project is ongoing and in the works. And, you know, but it is something that takes about half a decade to do. It's not an easy project. it's a serious infrastructure construction project. And so in the meantime, we're sort of, you know, stuck with this as it stands.
There you have it. Noah Asimo of the Vineyard Gazette, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, Steve.
This week, Governor Baker offered his first public comments on the Massachusetts Army National Guard's proposal to build a machine gun range on Joint Base Cape Cod. CAI's Eve Zuckoff was there to capture what the governor said. She joins us now. Hi, Eve.
Hi there, Steve.
Eve, let's be clear here. You're actually the one who asked Governor Baker about the range and got him to comment on this. And tell us, what did he say he's thinking about?
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so Governor Charlie Baker said his administration has questions about the environmental and public safety impacts of the proposed range. I have a lot of follow-up questions about what that means, but we didn't get to them this time. But he said the project is going to really have to go through a series of reviews. There's going to be a really significant and aggressive outreach program. Again, no details on what that means. But this follows the criticism from environmentalists and public officials up and down the Cape that have talked about their concerns about traffic, about noise, about deforestation. 170 acres of trees would be clear cut to make way for this 8-lane range, and potential impacts on groundwater that runs beneath the base that, you know, serves all the Upper Cape towns their drinking water.
So remind us, what power does the governor have over this project? Where does the whole thing stand right now?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a tricky question. And I'll just really quickly also add here that the Massachusetts Army National Guard, they say they really need this range to train soldiers more efficiently. And Governor Baker is the commander of the National Guard in Massachusetts. His questions about public safety, as much as environmentalists may hear that and think he's talking about, environmental impacts, others may hear that and think, no, he's thinking about the need to train soldiers. It wouldn't actually be the first time, if he knocked out this project, that a governor in Massachusetts said no to a machine gun range project. In 1998, Governor Salucci knocked down a very similar project. But after that happened, a group called the Environmental Management Commission was formed that we believe has kind of the final vote on this. It's not 100% clear, but really the next step in the approval process is a community advisory meeting that has yet to be scheduled.
Okay, so there are questions about impacts on water quality in that story. You reported a very different water quality story this week about cyanobacteria growing in local ponds. First, can we talk about how we're doing this summer with blooms? Where are they? How problematic have they been?
Right. And just as a quick reminder, cyanobacteria are these kind of like blue, they're typically naturally occurring. They're totally fine to see in ponds. They've been around for millions of years, but they can overgrow. And people will typically see them in their ponds if they start seeing this like blue-green bright green, scummy algae on the surface of their ponds. And at this point, 18 ponds on the Cape have had advisories, swimming advisories and closures this summer. That's looking pretty similar to past summers, but we're really going to need more data to make sense of if there's an increase or what's going on. This is the time we see them peak, late July, early August, and they're up and down the Cape. The Association to Preserve Cape Cod has a map on its website that's just lit up from Falmouth to Brewster and beyond. But thankfully, we have not heard of anyone yet, any people, any dogs that have been sickened after swimming in pond water like this, because that's what happens. Cyanobacteria can produce toxins that, when ingested, can be dangerous. They can create everything from, you know, stomach aches and headaches to organ failure in really high concentrations.
Now, you have been following this story for some time, but your latest reporting is focused on some new cyanobacteria research. Tell us what these local scientists are looking at.
Yeah, it's a really interesting area of research. These people are looking at cyanobacteria that is not just in those surface scums, but actually comes into the air. It's another route of exposure to the cyanotoxins that they can produce. And so researchers with the University of New Hampshire are really focusing their efforts in Brewster with the Brewster Ponds Coalition, where they have a group of volunteers helping them collect data. And eventually what they're hoping to do is to be able to get answers about, you know, are humans getting exposed to cyanotoxins in the air? Is that an issue? Should we be afraid of that? Eventually, they'll want to create a model that doesn't require them to be on the ground in the ponds, but actually able to predict when there will be cyanotoxins in the air. It's a really interesting area. And already, actually, some of the research they've done seems to indicate that ponds that looked the clearest might still contain the form of cyanobacteria most likely to produce airborne toxins. I mean, it's really interesting stuff, but absolutely not mature enough yet for people to worry when they're walking around the ponds breathing in the air.
We have just a couple of minutes here, and I want to talk about another story you reported this week about North Atlantic right whales. A new report came out that found that speed limits for ships and boats larger than 65 feet, these speed limits are designed to protect the critically endangered whales, that they're probably ineffective. They are ineffective. How big is this problem?
Yeah, it's really, I think it was really surprising to the researchers, this one. They found that, let's start, you know, south first. They found that looking at some ports and some areas where there are closures, or there are, excuse me, speed limits in place for ships and boats over 65 feet to protect right whales, the speed limits are getting ignored in mandatory areas as much as 90% of the time. And we know that ship strikes, collisions with ships, are a leading cause of death for these whales. Now, locally, Race Point actually had the highest level of compliance, 67% of boats did slow down. Cape Cod Bay compliance was lower, it was around 55%. And this is really, I think it's disappointing for researchers who say that, you know, almost 50 whales have died in the last 4 years. Their population is now around 360. And this is not a way that we should be seeing them go out.
So briefly here, what's the answer? What's the group calling for?
Yeah, the group is calling for a number of things. They want new speed zones. The same speed zones have been in place since 2008. They want to see a new one, particularly in an area south of Martha's Vineyard where right whales seem to be spending more time. They want boats shorter than 65 feet to be included in those speed limits, because a calf died earlier this year colliding with a 54-foot boat that wasn't required to. They have a lot of ideas, and I think they're hopeful that federal regulators will hear them out.
That is CAI's environment reporter, Eve Zuckoff. Eve, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
And that's our show for today. I want to thank my guests. We spoke with CAI's Jeanette Barnes, Sam Houghton, and Daniel Ackerman. We heard from George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Spoke with Casey Myers at the Provincetown Independent and Jason Graziadei of N Magazine and Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette. And, of course, CAI's Eve Zuckoff there. Big thanks to Dan Tridle engineering the program from here in our station at Woods Hole. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.